Hello, welcome to Oh God, What Now? I'm Dorian Lynskey. On today's show, a long read in The New Yorker by Sam Knight has basically summed up 14 years of Tory rule in one word, failure. We'll discuss its wretched legacy. Plus, we'll be talking about how to fix the damage with our guest Will Hutton, Observer columnist and author of This Time No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain. And in the extra bit for Patreon supporters, we'll ask the panel for the books that most influence their political beliefs. Let's meet the panel. First, the author of The Future of Trust and host of Jam Tomorrow, Roz Taylor. Hi, Roz.
Hello, Doreen.
It's a mixed picture for Starmer this week, with 20 Lancashire councillors resigning in protest at his leadership, membership down by 25,000 since January, part of a general decline since the high watermark of Corbynism in that very one specific way. But 4 in 5 of the current members support his leadership. So is this actually the same picture? The flight of the left, the consolidation of support for Starmer?
Yes, I think it is, briefly. It shows that Gaza is still, though, a live issue among many parts of the Labour Party, and there's very strong feeling about it. And he shouldn't underestimate that. I mean, we're still seeing regular big demonstrations in central London. We're still seeing continued outrage, and especially over the killing of aid workers in the Israeli airstrike, even this week. So it will be a live issue, but that isn't to say that it in any way represents a threat to him. That said, the Greens are very much lining themselves up as an alternative to Labour on these issues. They are being quite successful, I think, at drawing what you might call clear green lines between themselves and Labour. And one of those is obviously the Green Imperative, with the loss of the Green Prosperity Plan or part of it. One of those is the Green Belt, which Labour is okay with building over in certain circumstances. And another one is Gaza. So that is one to watch.
Hello to Associate Political Editor of The New Statesman, Rachel Cunliffe.
Hello.
You wrote last week about two ministers not just standing down, but leaving Westminster, Robert Halfen, who I have heard of, and James Heapy, who I have not. But as you point out, they don't actually hate Sunak.
No.
Is it just despair? Or just there are better things they could be doing?
I think it's a lot of what's the point, I guess. So those two resignations were surprising because they were both quite well-respected ministers in a cross-party way. Labour was actually quite positive and complimentary about the work that James Heapy had done as Armed Forces Minister. Robert Halfen has spent his entire career in Parliament working really hard on education, particularly further education and skills. They were resigning as ministers now because they don't want to stand again in the general election. And they both wrote these resignation letters that were really complimentary about, you know, Sunak's a great chap and we wish him all the best.
It's not you, it's me.
It's not you, it's me. And I think some of it is about wanting to have more of an impact and realising that you can do that possibly better outside of Westminster than you can in opposition. Some of it, I think, is just being really tired. Robert Halfen has been an MP since 2010 and I think is just exhausted. I think it's a bit different from some of the 2019ers who have said that they're not going to stand to be MPs. And I think with that lot, it is to do with having come in on the big Boris wave and realising that Westminster isn't what they thought it was.
There's also a very high number of American members of Congress quitting early and literally not saying, I'll leave, I won't run again. Literally, they're like, I'm off now. You'll just have to find somebody else. And the main reason there just seems to be that being in Congress is awful.
So I think being a politician is miserable now. I think it's probably always been less glamorous than people thought it was when they went into it. But I think the level of scrutiny that you get, which is a good thing, but when it's an obsession with people's personal lives, lack of privacy can really get too much. There's that. There's the threats to MPs' families and their safety, which has really become a very live issue in recent months, but has been getting worse. There's the fact that in Britain, not so much congressmen in the US, but in Britain, you don't get paid very much compared to other roles that people in those positions think that they could be off doing. That's why they all, take second jobs. And some of them get embroiled in lobbying scandals. So I just don't think it's that appealing. And then you get into it and you realise that if you want to have a career and you want to progress, you just have to suck up to whoever's in charge of your party for years and years and years until maybe you get a go for, in Liz Truss's case, 7 weeks.
I think a yardstick of that is there's nearly 100 MPs now of slightly more Tories proportionally than Labour, but nonetheless, Labour in the can as well, who've been one way or another reprimanded for misconduct of some sort. I mean, nearly 100 MPs out of 651. And that's astonishingly high. That's more than 15%. And it's kind of, and actually, you know, reflects, you know, their idleness, their sense they're not being used, their sense of acres of time in the bar and you know, untoward things and stupid things and things they shouldn't do happen. So I think it's kind of a barometer of that kind of discontent. This is, I think, a parliament unequaled the number of people who've been reprimanded.
And that is our guest today, Will Hutton.
Sorry.
That's fine. Columnist for The Observer and author of This Time No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain, which is published next week. Hi, Will.
Hi, hello. Pleased to be here.
You cheered on Twitter Gordon Brown's new plan to break the doom loop of poverty and raise billions.
I did, yeah.
What is it?
I mean, first of all, I mean, I don't know whether I'm as optimistic as Mr. Gordon Brown, but he says that there is a review of the welfare state going to happen when Labour's elected, if Labour's elected. Part and parcel of which will be kind of some relief for the extraordinary north of 4 million children living in poverty, of whom, you know, the bulk, vast bulk, are members of families that work. So his solution is, let's find some money and find it in ways which actually don't cost the within the fiscal envelope. And I thought they were inventive ways, actually. One, I mean, it's probably not everyone listening to this podcast will kind of be aware of this, but actually clearing banks have to deposit money with the Bank of England at their cash reserve ratio, as it's called. Up until quite recently, they didn't get any interest in that money. And the government has now decided to pay them interest. Gordon's notion is, well, no, that they can pay the interest into a special fund designated to relieve child poverty. Secondly, he wants to encourage rich people to donate more. And thirdly, he wants to shame companies into donating more. And through those three avenues, he thinks you can put together a fund of between £4 and £5 billion a year, which, pending this kind of review, can be used to kind of really address child poverty. And I thought, I'd give it three cheers. Yeah.
Good. It's a very encouraging start to the episode. Let's begin. British journalists always seem to have more impact when they write for prestigious American publications, and that's certainly the case with The New Yorker's Sam Knight, whose long read, What Have 14 Years of Conservative Rule Done to Britain, has gone viral, with its well-reported indictment of the Tories' 50 Shades of Failure. He writes, covering British politics during this period has been like trying to remember and explain a very convoluted and ultimately boring dream. is this that how it feels to us all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it must seem very weird. Do you think, well, as to an American reader that perhaps has not been keeping up? I mean, even just the kind of mid-season character introduction of Liz Truss, you know, like a kind of unsuccessful
I think it's
boyfriend in Friends, where they just go, well, the viewers don't really like this person, they're going.
I think we've got a bit of a fascination with how others see us, and perhaps, I think, a feeling that we might begin to understand the cataclysm of the last 14 years if we can see it through eyes that are not our own, because it might start to make sense. I must say, I haven't found it boring. I found it exasperating. I found it wholly irrational. I found it infuriating, but it has not been boring.
Because the point that he makes, he draws a distinction between this government and, say, the Tory rule with Thatcher and Major and obviously New Labour. And I think New Labour has a much more explicable arc. And I suppose the Tory rule, which is like, it comes in and it's got these big ideas and then it succeeds in some and it fails in others and unintended consequences and lapses of judgment and egos and yada, yada. And then there's this decline. Whereas what you see here is not really like a decline of one project, but just a shuffling of projects. So it's like, clearly you've got the Cameron Osborne austerity era and then you've got the Brexit era. But then there's these other sorts of like mini eras, including Truss's 49 days. So it is actually quite a complicated story to tell. Is it one government per prime minister? It's certainly a lot of phases.
What it struck me was the way the piece conveyed that it felt as though the Tories were treating the country as a giant experiment. So there was Osborne and Cameron. How much austerity could we get away with?
Yeah.
There was Boris Johnson, who is an entire experiment by himself. You know, how could we have thought that he was fit to be PM? Well, we thought so because large sections of the media, many of whom he knew personally, told us so. There was Dominic Cummings as a sort of subsection of the Boris experiment, which fizzled out. There was Liz Truss. And I don't mention May and Sunak because fundamentally their role is to try and clean up. But it has been a series of different experiments on the British state. And I don't think we quite realised that was what was happening at the time.
And does this multiplicity of kind of agendas make it very hard for the Tories, one, to have a legacy that they can boast about, and two, take responsibility? You know, that, like I said, at the end of New Labour, there was largely the same people that had been there at the beginning, and they could go, well, this is what we did, and maybe this is what we did wrong. Whereas here, it just seems that they're constantly going, pointing at other people and going, well, it wasn't really us.
Yeah.
That was the whole Sunak thing, wasn't it? It was just like, I'm going to reverse these years of failure. And it was like, wasn't that you guys? And he's going, well, it wasn't me. I wasn't Prime Minister.
Yeah. Well, as I pointed out, I mean, Boris Johnson thought that, you know, he was putting an end to austerity and he thought levelling up would somehow finish off that policy. And of course, then COVID came along and spoiled all his plans for him. But not that I believe it was a fully thought out idea anyway. It was merely a distraction from the consequences of Brexit. But yes, it is hard to pin down what the overwhelming narrative has been, except I would say that we didn't grasp, or the Tories themselves perhaps didn't even grasp at the beginning, that austerity wasn't some sort of one-off. It wasn't like rationing, where rationing would come to an end and then we would be able to eat more things again. It was something that damaged the state in all kinds of ways and which will take even more money to reverse the effects of. It was an attack on the whole fabric of society in Britain. And I don't think that was fully appreciated at the time.
Well, I don't want to let any individuals off the hook here, but one of the arguments in your book is really sort of about the last days of neoliberalism. And is the sort of the chaos and confusion of these 14 years almost like the morbid symptoms of a failing model?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this kind of fumbling around for policies that work is quite the right way of seeing it. My argument is that actually, from 1979 onward, the country's been the kind of victim of four huge, calamitous mistakes, all of them based around this ideology that markets and individuals within and firms within markets can be relied upon to self-organize themselves to best outcomes. We all know that story. And actually, first, there's a variant of that, monetarism, collapse in public investment, evisceration of a manufacturing base, kind of scarring large parts of the North Midlands, all of which voted Brexit 30 years later. Mistake two, again, around the same philosophy, was you can let the financial markets free, led to the kind of booming credit and the financial crash. Then when Osborne and Cameron take over, austerity is not a visitation from, you know, planet Zog. Actually, they're repeating almost exactly what Geoffrey Howe and Mrs. Thatcher did in 1980, around the same idea that actually that will release resource because it's crowding out public any kind of taxation or public act, it's crowding out the private, and which is the virtuous part of the economy which we must stimulate. And then you have a similar take on the same kind of ideology, Brexit. We're going to be freed from the shackles of Brussels. So that similar kind of ideology governs four calamitous policy mistakes, punctuated with the last one, the 49 days of libertarian Liz Truss. I mean, the country is actually now saying no, I think, hugely. I think there is virtually no risk, 1% risk, John Curtis says, the pollster, of there being the Tories getting back, and that may be overestimating it. And they want something different. And one of the reasons why the Tory party has collapsed into a kind of federation of ungovernable cults is because, you know, that governing ideology, which they deify, you know, Thatcherism and the goddess, and has actually collapsed in front of their eyes. And I think that the Conservative Party is, and the right, and here's, not everyone may agree with this, but I think you know, for a prolonged period, if the first past the post carries on, which may or may not, are being in the wilderness.
Rachel, there are some quite damning quotes from unnamed sources here. You've spoken to quite a few unnamed Tory sources yourself in your reporting. You're very good at illuminating what's going
and
on in this
named.
Confederation of cults. Yes, no, and you know, some are willing to step forward. One former advisor says they're not on a mission to do X, Y, or Z. You win and you govern because we're better at it, right? Which reminds me of the David Cameron, I think I'd be good at it. And then a strategist says, it's all about constantly drawing dividing lines. That's all you need. It's not about big ideological debates or policies or anything. And Sam Knight sort of says it's not like Thatcherism or Blairism, and there really wasn't like a big idea. Is that fair, do you think? Was there at some point a mission that got lost? Is there, because, you know, sometimes we do go, well, these people seem very, some of these people like Truss seem very ideologically driven.
Yeah, I think that there is a sense in which the Conservatives see themselves as the natural party of government, and their internal narrative is we can't let Labour get in because look at what they did last time. They always overspend. They always have too much, you know, statism, and we just have to stay in power at all costs. And they prioritise power for its own sake in a way that Labour traditionally isn't very good at. I do think that some of those characters in that 14-year saga did have an ideology. I think austerity was an ideological project. There was a sense in the Cameron Osborne cohort that the state was had grown too big, was doing too much stuff, and that shrinking the state was a good thing in itself, partly to save money, which we need to do, but also partly because we'll all be a more productive, dynamic economy. Really looking at what the consequences of that would be. I've actually spoken to some Conservative MPs and sort of former advisors from that era who kind of said, what the problem with the austerity project is they tried to cut spending radically without focusing on what areas, what things they actually wanted to cut. So they tried to basically carry on with the state doing everything that it had been doing before, but with half the budget and much, much worse. And we're seeing the consequence of that in criminal justice, courts, policing, social care, childhood malnutrition, social mobility, all of that stuff. We're seeing it now. They tried to do everything with half the cost, and as Ross said, it ended up much more expensive.
Well, Ross, did you find that George Osborne was almost like, it's almost he'd had like villain lines scripted for him because he, you know, he's sort of saying, oh, well, austerity was devastatingly politically effective and it was the only option available. And then you see that it's damaged like schools and courts and youth services and mental health and child poverty, et cetera, et cetera. Did he seem like somebody that just hadn't like learned anything? I suppose financially and career-wise, he hasn't had to learn anything.
No, he hasn't. And he's got himself a nice podcast now, I believe, in which he can justify his actions. But moving on. But no, I mean, it's incredibly cynical. I mean, I think the most cynical aspect of it was that he cut the things that would hit the poorest hardest. I mean, what's the easy stuff when, you know, child benefit for higher earners? And I remember when I was pregnant in 2009, I got something called a health in pregnancy grant. It was about 180 quid and it was supposed to ensure that I ate enough during pregnancy. So, you know, he cut away that sort of thing. And then after that, he went for things like the courts, the youth services, local government, things that, with local government especially, it's particularly useful because you can almost always blame the council themselves, as the Tories are doing now in Birmingham. But things where the victims of those cuts did not enjoy huge amounts of public sympathy. And one of the most insightful things about the New Yorker piece, I thought, was that the top 20% of the population were insulated from those cuts. People who didn't tend to go near a criminal court, people whose kids didn't go to a youth club, people who barely used council services, people who didn't claim benefits, all those people were okay because the value of their houses kept going up. So that concealed, it hid the true extent of the cuts, and the nature of our media also meant that they didn't really filter through. And then we had Brexit, which functioned as the most enormous distraction from all these problems.
You write quite a long section, Will, about what you call the media firewall protecting the Tories. Is that one reason why they have been allowed to be so bad? Because they've got these people that they sold austerity and they sold Brexit, and then they, up to a certain point, kept assuring Tory prime ministers that they were doing rather well.
Well, that's part of the story, and also part of the story is that, you know, the Liberal left haven't been very good at kind of making a positive case. I mean, there's both their strength and kind of liberal left weakness. So that's, you know, part of the book is exploring that. I mean, I've been working in British journalism for longer than I like to think, actually, more than 40 years. And I mean, and the power of the right-wing press has grown in that period. So, I mean, it actually frames the national conversation. You know, what we talk about, whether it be, you know, flags on the back of England shirts, or whether it be whether J.K. Rowling is going to be done over for hate crimes in Scotland, you know, is to frame by them. You know, there wasn't a framing around the kind of colossal suffering. I think there's no better way of describing it.
Rachel, there are many, many more think tanks on the right than on the left. You've interviewed quite a few thinkers on the right for the New Statesman. Are there any sort of heavyweights that you would set against Rory Stewart's description of the Tories largely as clever, silly, unserious people? Are there people that you think do have real substance, do have a project, and that may play a part in renovating the Tory party in one direction or another? And it doesn't matter if you think their ideas are absolutely toxic, just... do they have the brains and the seriousness?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of conversations going on. I think the big question that is being asked, both within the parliamentary party and also in the think tank ecosystem, is, hang on, we've been in power for 14 years, and other than Brexit, we don't have any policy achievements to show for it. And that is a real anxiety.
How they consider that an achievement. I mean, I mean, the private...
it's a mixed blessing, I'd say.
Got it done.
Yeah, I mean... in private, increasingly, you know, they'll say the jury's out, or it may take another 20 years to see the benefits. But there's very few people who can actually say, what a great choice we made in 2016, and the benefits are there for all to see.
No, but even if you take Brexit out of it, you know, where are the improvements to schools? I mean, the reading scores have gone up a bit. They'll sort of talk sort of warmly about Michael Gove reforms, and then you remind them that school ceilings are falling down because they're made with dodgy concrete. Yeah. You know, where's the entrepreneurial dynamism that we were promised? Basically, why, if you were in power for that long, why has the state not been reshaped in the image of conservative feminism? A lot of people are trying to answer that question. A lot of it comes down to the fact that there are at least two, probably more, but two very clear factions within the Conservative Party who hate each other, one of which is the free market, Thatcherite, Singapore on Thames section. And then there's the more, what we now call the new conservatives, but sort of socially conservative, tradition, community, king and country.
Danny Kruger kind of people.
Exactly, those kind of people. And Danny Kruger, I think, is going to have a real, very important role in shaping the future of the party. Miriam Cates, the other new conservative, is almost certainly going to lose her seat, but Danny Kruger's got a safe seat. So watch out for him. Watch out also for Nick Timothy, Theresa May's former aide and sort of the vision behind her Just About Managing project that she briefly tried to do before Brexit got in the way of everything. And I think he would say, and I would actually agree with him, that they identified in that the Just About Managing people who were struggling, who'd never seen themselves having to rely on the state before, and now felt like they'd done everything right and things were really, really hard. I think that is a real challenge that they identified. They just weren't able to make any progress towards it, and neither was Boris Johnson with levelling up. Mark Littlewood, who was director of the Institute of Economic Affairs, the think tank behind Liz Truss, he's still floating around with the Popcons, the Popular Conservatives, with Liz Truss herself, who one of her former aides says sees herself as a free market fairy godmother.
She's the only conservative in the room, she proclaims, doesn't she? And when she advertises her book, which is published in the next few days. And again, I found myself the only conservative in the room. And what we need is a return to conservatism. And you think to yourself, well, you know, variants of that have been tried the last 14 years, Liz, and you yourself tried it with calamitous results. I mean, what are you talking about?
It's the deep state.
I'm really excited to read her demented book. Roz, one of the quotes that really struck me, it's an academic who says that Britain was suffering from a chronic case of financial melancholia and in a sort of an inability to think about the future. And that in a way, one of the big legacies of Tory rule is this kind of like spiritual malaise thing. Nothing works and things aren't going to get better. Is that something that Labour needs to address on a kind of like vibes level to, because I think the newness, I'm actually quite excited about Labour coming in. And I think that whatever people think of Starmer and not being terribly inspiring, I think just the fact that there is change will at least create a kind of a brief uptick of optimism. But do you think that actually that's a challenge, which is not just about where do you find the money for this and all the pragmatic stuff, but to actually create a sense of that you can think about the future in a way, in a positive way?
Yeah, I think it will take time. I think they need to build trust first. I would say that, obviously, about trust. But I think there has to be a degree of the government just behaving rationally for a while. Then I think the next thing after that is that Britain has to decide what sort of country it is and it wants to be in the world now. Do we want to manufacture solar panels? Do we want to manufacture wind turbines? Do we want to actually invest properly in our universities, which have international reputation, but are struggling on many levels now? What are we really good at? And what do we want to do? And get a sense of ourselves as a country and how we fit into the modern world back. But we have to get that back, because at the moment we are living in a sort of, in a world where we seem to think that we can achieve almost anything if we try hard enough. But at the same time, we can't achieve anything and everything is broken. Mm. And that's a complete, there's a cognitive dissonance there that it's impossible to overcome. That will take a while. I mean, at least 18 months.
That's good. 18 months to save Britain. Now let's have a question for one of our Patreon backers in But Your Emails. If you support us, you too can submit a question to the panel. This week's question comes from G.F. Poynton, who sounds like an Edwardian novelist. My question relates to the Conservatives' apparent disdain for public services and the need for consistent funding and support. Please can you explain why exactly Conservative governments appear happy to allow our public services, surely the bedrock of civic society, to visibly disintegrate almost to the point of collapse? Travelling through other European countries, I'm often astonished and envious of the way in which things just seem to work, and not only work, but also beautifully and thoughtfully designed with the happiness and needs of people in mind. Do these very basic requirements simply not figure within the Tory mindset? Well, do the Tories sort of care about the public realm? The last 14 years would suggest not.
Their view is that, I mean, if Liz Truss was here, she would say, well, you've got to get the economy motoring, and that's the root of that is tax cuts and all that pain on public services. And when the economy is motoring, that'll produce the tax revenues that will allow us to have good public services. I think it's wrong on two levels. I don't think that tax cuts generate growth. And I think that actually having a strong kind of social contract come public services is kind of integral to actually a good economy. And I argue that, you know, the good economy, the good society needs both a kind of floor and ladder. And capitalism provides the ladder, although it needs to be informed by a kind of mindfulness. It has to and a social license to operate, and if it doesn't deliver the common good, it won't last long. But the social floor has to be kind of really robust. Now, I think One Nation Tories, way back in the day, thought along those lines. But I think kind of the exposure to kind of market fundamentalism, the revival of laissez-faire economics, the belief that actually the state's got to get out of the way, they end up kind of where we are, in which they say, you know, it doesn't matter if you have to wait 2 years for a court judgment, or there's only, 30 places in the prison system, or schools are crumbling, all the things we've been discussing in the last kind of, you know, that is, you know, the consequence of the noble effort to get the state off entrepreneurial Britain's back, and then there'll be a great leap forward, and it will become global buccaneers and all the stuff that all that language recognise. So I think the answer to your kind of email is, I'm afraid that I think that kind of this generation of Conservatives, unlike previous generations of Conservatives, I read the Harold Macmillan's book, The Middle Way, he wrote it in 1938.
So did I the other day.
Extraordinary. Yeah. It's extraordinary. I mean, you know, Macmillan would not buy any of that. And that generation of post-war Tories didn't buy it either. And actually, the legitimacy they earned by not buying it, and that legitimacy has been conferred onto their successors, who abuse it by returning to market fundamentalism, individualism, and all that, and wrecking our public services.
Rachel, are the communitarians, you know, the Kruger-Cates lot, are they interested in this? Because because generally what I get from them is a lot of like very hardline social conservatism. But you would think that part of their vision perhaps was included sort of libraries and parks and thriving communities. Do they talk about public services much?
They talk about civic pride and pride in communities. And I think it is something that they're interested in. I think some of the reason for why the Conservatives are so seem to not care about public services is because they've wrecked them by accident. And I actually think a lot of it is incompetence rather than design. And I think there is a reluctance to talk about public services now because it means admitting that what was done in 2010 was the wrong thing to do. There's some of that. I also think there is a wariness, even with the Danny Kruger sort of community-minded national new conservatives, that their lot. There's an idea that a suspicion of public bodies that run things, institutions, quangos. There's still very much an idea that even though you've heard this with the launch of the Popcons, Liz Truss talked about it, that even though the Conservatives have been in power for 14 years, Blair sort of stacked the deck against them with all the institutions. And that means that, yes, we do like libraries and we do like parks and we do like museums, but we can't trust any of the people running them because they've all got, you know, woke left-wing ideas. And so we're not going to support them in practice because we don't trust the people running them.
Is that perhaps like the other thing, apart from, you know, the kind of legacy of Thatcherism, don't trust the state, is that at the point where they're attacking the National Trust, which is not like a public service, but is a beloved political institution. And basically, they just
woke
keep
scones.
Pointing
woke
at things,
scones.
Woke scones. Like if everything is, like vegan margarine is woke, everything is woke. Is that sort of, does that sort of compound the problem that not only are they not, have they not invested enough in public services and are letting, you know, libraries and swimming pools close down, but the things that they don't really have to put a lot of money into and are self-sustaining and very popular, they seem to hate them as well.
Yeah, I mean, they don't like scrutiny for the reasons that Rachel mentioned. And you see this at the moment with water and sewage and the impotence of Ofwat to do anything about it and to actually ensure that the water companies stop discharging sewage into our waters. They are basically incapable of doing so. And you see a similar problem with Ofgem and gas bills and so on. These bodies do exist, but they don't have the teeth to do really anything about it when these public services go so massively wrong. And they're not trusted by the Conservatives to act in the right way anyway. So you've sold off the water companies, you've put something like Ofwat in place to try to ensure that despite their being privatised, they should still provide a decent service, and it doesn't work.
Next up, the UK economy, as you may have noticed from our discussion so far, has been limping along for a long time now, and many of its problems predate the 2008 crisis, let alone Brexit. Will Hutton has taken the long view in his new book, explained why we're in such a lousy position, and offered some remedies that Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves might like to check out. Will, you write, among many rather cross lines, it is time to stop talking of Britain as a rich and broadly fair country. We are poor, our society is deeply unfair, and we're living on the edge. And you describe this as an angry book. Was it written in a spirit of like, because you've been writing books for some time, outlining some of these problems. Are you just all out of patience?
I am angry, yeah. I think there's a bunch of avoidable mistakes were made. The big ones I've already mentioned, but I mean, there's a second tier of kind of lesser blunders, all kind of the origins in the same kind of overarching philosophy. So you privatise, for example, the probation service, and then after 4 years have to renationalize it. And there's acres and acres of mistakes like that that have taken place, not just the last 14 years, but, you know, during this kind of 45-year hegemony of this laissez-faire economics. And so I do feel like that. And actually, the book's gestation was actually in 2022 when, first of all, Boris Johnson, disgraceful resignation. I mean, it was extraordinary. I mean, we forget. I mean, if you exclude kind of trade ambassadors, kind of 57 ministers and members of his government, 57 resigned. It hasn't happened in British politics at scale, just disgust at this man. And then the amazing kind of Liz Truss coming in for a 49. I just thought, I've had enough.
Stop writing.
Exactly.
I think I first became aware of you with The State We're In back in 96. It was very well received and influential and was obviously read by a lot of New Labour ministers. Looking back, how much of what you were calling for in that book was actually delivered by New Labour, and how much did they fall short from what your hopes were? Because we're in a similar moment now, right? We're waiting for Labour to come in and hoping they're going to do a lot.
I mean, too little is the straight answer. I mean, they did some of the things that they kind of cherry picked ideas that kind of they found agreeable, and stuff that meant confronting business and finance or reshaping the savings and investment system they shrank from. And I mean, the financial crash 2007-2008 could have been less severe. It would have happened, I think, anyway, given what was happening in the States, but would have been less severe had they been more minded to be tougher with the banks in that 10 years. They were in office before the crisis broke. They didn't really take reshaping the British state as seriously as I wanted them to. On the other hand, you know, it has to be said that given what's happened since 2010, it rather puts the New Labour years in kind of slightly rosier kind of, you know, I mean, frankly, I mean, you know, when they left office, there were 3,500 Sure Start centres. Fantastic. For families and mothers in particular, with kids preschool years, you know, now there's less than 1,000. You know, the kind of evisceration of things like that. You know, I thought asset based welfare was great. I thought the child trust funds were great. I mean, and you know, the academy schools did actually deliver improved academic performance, particularly in London. And public investments as a share of GDP did rise from kind of 1% of GDP to 3% of GDP in the Labour years. So you know, you have to give two cheers, if not, we can't give them three. I mean, you know, the great financial crash, the war in Iraq, the lack of willingness to kind of really tackle the underlying problems facing the British economy are all marks against them. But, you know, given what we've been discussing, had New Labour been in office for the last 14 years, I don't think the position would be so calamitous as the one we're living in.
What you call for is a fusion of an ethic of socialism with the best of progressive liberalism. Which I imagine socialists will go, well, that's not socialism. Can you explain that and what that, because you do tell the history of essentially of the Labour Party, but also liberalism. And, you know, you're talking about a long span of sort of trying to get this right. And obviously there's always a suspicion that whenever you talk of fusion and balance, people are just like, well, is this just centrism? You know, is this just New Labour again? So what is the thing that you're proposing, the fusion that maybe we haven't had before or that we haven't had for a long time?
Well, when Clem Attlee was asked by 55 what he understood by socialism, he replied, fellowship. He said, I agree with William Morris, perhaps the greatest citizen of this borough, that fellowship is hope. It's the hope of the world. It's the hope of this country. And fellowship is socialism. And that's how he chose to kind of define socialism. And you know, I do think there's a kind of ethic of socialism which comes from fellowship, comes from ideas of mutuality, and comes from very kind of deep roots in religion about, you know, you share one bread, we all share one bread, we take communion. It's Aristotle, he kind of says, men and women partake of society, and those who say they don't are either a beast or a god, which my challenge is, you know, was Mrs. Thatcher a beast or a god? You know, I mean, these ideas are kind of very deep rooted, as is an idea of a social contract kind of emerging out of the Enlightenment. You know, I do think that ethic is extremely powerful. Part of the book, I try to argue that, you know, the good economy and good society has both a social floor informed by an ethic of socialism, but also a ladder. And here I stumbled across the work of a chap called Thomas Green, who wrote The Politics of Obligation in the 1870s. He was taking on classic liberalism and saying, look, you know, individuals are of society, society is of individual. The stronger you are as an individual, that'll help society get stronger. The stronger society is, the stronger you'll be as an individual. There's a mutual interdependence, and you have an obligation, and it's a positive obligation to make society strong. And progressive liberalism, you know, gave us Keynes and gave us Beveridge. So I kind of, what I try to say is that rather than actually, you know, one philosophy kind of be owned by people who call themselves liberals, and one philosophy owned by people who call themselves socialist, actually these two, like a Venn diagram, hugely overlap. And if you're a politician, you know, and you want to kind of sell a bunch of ideas, kind of trying to selling the idea of a floor and a ladder, and actually a capitalism which actually has got a social conscience and is aware, those who run it, that they've got to work for the common good, you know, you're onto something. And I think that most people in Britain, or certainly a consistent majority, would vote for that.
Do you see what you're looking for in the rhetoric of Starmer and Reeves, particularly, I think, Reeves' Mace lecture, which kind of impressed quite a lot of people? Because, again, the lazy critique is that they are just a pair of, like, kind of centrists, and it's sort of reheated New Labour, yada, yada. You seem to sort of think, actually, that because we're in a different phase of the life cycle of neoliberalism, that actually what they're up to is something else. How much sort of faith do you have in those individuals and the people around them to work towards what you're talking about?
I do have faith in them in this sense. I'm pretty sure they lean into this body of ideas. I'm pretty sure they would like to do as much of it as they feasibly can. And then that gets the core of it, you know, what's feasible. And I think they're still kind of minimalist in what they think is feasible rather than maximalist. I'll be lucky if I get half a loaf. But Reeves in the Mays lecture, Rachel Reeves, I mean, in the Q&A session afterwards, was questioned about this, you know, are you a Thatcherite, really? Because that's what was all billed there. He said, no, I joined the Labour Party because I wasn't a Thatcher. I was not a Thatcher. I protested about it. I thought the consequences of Thatcherism in lived communities was terrible. Hence, I joined the Labour Party. That's me. And actually read her book, you know, on women economists. They're all of them from the left, bar a couple. And she's very admiring of them. She name checks them, some of them, in her Mays lecture. And what I don't think people have picked up sufficiently, but I think that the changes she made to the fiscal rules, stripping capital investment out of the measurement of the deficit, trying to promote the net worth of the public sector so that assets grow, schools, hospitals, roads grow faster than liabilities, the debt should, opens the way to big borrowing for public investment, do the things that they were going to do when they were talking about 28 billion, but they'll get through this run-up to an election period without being sniped at the entire time. So, you know, whether or not there's enough behind it on the social floor, where they recognize the scale of transformation that's required in our public services and actually in our savings and investment system to get the growth they want, I'm not sure they're there. And they're certainly not there on the question of Europe. It's going to be very difficult to become the fastest growing economy in the G7, one of the missions, without more access to the European markets than they're currently talking about. And they're not brave enough to talk about that.
Well, there is a bravery issue. Like you said, Osborne says in that New Yorker piece, rather smugly, the underlying economic arguments have basically been accepted. He means austerity. It's rather like the Thatcher period. Everyone complained that Thatcher did deindustrialization, elegantly put, George. And yet no one wants to unpick it. Is he right that if the main critique of New Labour is perhaps accepting too much of sort of Thatcherism, but let's just do it in a nicer way? I mean, there's much less of a substantial legacy to accept from this Tory government. But do you think that Labour will have that courage, that intellectual courage, to actually unpick things and go, well, no, this was wrong. This doesn't work.
Rachel Reeves, importantly, I thought importantly, you know, Mays lectures, I've been going to, reading them, going to them, watching snippets of them all my career, have mainly talked about how public investment and public activity crowds out the private. And here was a shadow chancellor talking about public investment crowding in private investment. So in a way, I think they will be brave enough, but there's so many kind of ways they can get blown off course. And it's so important. I mean, and I'm not sure they realize how important it is. Kind of, it's so important that they govern well, because, I mean, the right will regroup. Farage ties the whole with GB News, you know, the whole kind of nexus. How important that will grow is anyone's guess. But if they misgovern and make some mistakes, you know, the road will be open for the right to make a very powerful case against them.
You've talked about public investment or private investment, changing the fiscal rules. Fundamentally, there isn't any money at the moment. What can they do quickly that doesn't cost much to try and get going?
Well, I mean, first of all, I really don't accept that taxation at 36 to 37% of GDP kind of breathes the life out of a capitalist economy. There are a number of kind of Western democracies who've got taxation a proportion of GDP significantly higher than that, doing much better than we are. So there is scope, if they choose, to tax the wealthy in ways to give them resource. For example, they could withdraw relief for higher earners on their pension contributions, phase it out over time. And there's other ideas like that that sit in the tax system. Secondly, I think they can borrow. Thirdly, I think there's kind of, once you've got power, the kind of things that Gordon Brown was floating in his article, which I spoke about earlier in the podcast, can be done. So I think there are those quick wins. In her speech, which I thought was amazingly not picked up, I sat bolt upright when she said it. We are going to reduce, she said, you know, in our first weeks in office, an urgent program of relief for distressed public services. If they get elected by November, the end of this year, you know, I would guess that by next summer, you know, June, July of 2025, they will begin to roll out a major infrastructure program, in particular, decarbonizing the national grid. You know, and that will stimulate jobs and growth in the Midlands and the North of England. And there's things they can do in constitutional reform too, I think they might do, particularly in ethics and government, which could be quite eye-catching. So for me, the hourglass is half full and potentially fillable, rather than half empty and likely to be emptied.
And that's the show. Thank you to Rachel.
Thank you.
Roz.
Thank you.
And Will Hutton, whose book, This Time No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain, is published on April the 11th. Stick around for the extra bit after Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a salute to our generous supporters, without whom we could not keep making podcasts. So why not join them for as little as £3 a month? Get this podcast early, without ads, plus lots more. Search Oh God, What Now? Patreon to find out how.
Hello and welcome to the Oh God, What Now? Deep State to Andrew Creese, Stephen Wright, ETSEC97 and Fergus Grant.
Many thanks for signing up to our secretive offshore slush fund to Tom Benson, Aidan, Catherine Middleton and Noreen Novell.
And finally, welcome to the Woke Blob to Ginny, Jerry McKenna, Charlotte and Steve Danielovich. We'll see you next time.
Oh God, What Now? Was written and presented by Dorian Lindsay, with Roz Taylor, Rachel Cunliffe, and guest Will Hutton.
It was produced by Chris Jones, with audio production from Robin Lieben, video production from Kieran Leslie, and art by Jim Parrott. Managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production.
Hello and welcome to The Extra Bit, exclusive to Patreon backers. This week we're going to talk about the books that have changed the way we think politically and why. And maybe we changed our minds back, who knows? Roz?
This was a difficult one because I wouldn't say that there's one book that has, you know, rocked my world politically. But I was thinking back and thinking about a number of books that were on my parents' bookshelves as I was growing up by a guy called Tony Parker, who was a sort of sociologist. And he's not really known or heard of much now, but he basically interviewed people, often people who society thought were beyond the pale, and he wrote books.
And that was a teaser for the bonus bit of this week's podcast. If you'd like to hear us natter about books a bit more, and you like a little bit more Oh God, What Now? Every week, without ads and a day early, then you can sign up to back us on Patreon for as little as £3 a month. You'll also get access to our exclusive monthly live minicast, Oh God, What Else?, and a chance to get your hands on some merchandise as well. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.